Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, W. Kamau Bell, is a familiar voice to KALW listeners. Kamau has used his unique blend of comedy and social and political satire to inform and raise awareness about some of the most critical issues of our time, especially race and systemic racism in the United States. In his new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, he writes about what it means to be a black man and how his experiences have shaped his life and his comedy. He writes, "I'm afraid of the cops, absolutely petrified of the cops. Simply put, I'm afraid of the cops because I am black. To raise the stakes even further, I am male. And to go all in on this pot of fear, I am 6'4" and weigh 250 pounds. In the book, Kamau also tackles fatherhood, the state of law enforcement, comedians, superheroes, right-wing and left-wing politics, failure, and his upbringing by very strong-willed, race-conscious, yet ideologically opposite parents. Kamau Bell is a sociopolitical comedian and host of the Emmy Award-nominated CNN docuseries United Shades of America. And on last night's show, it airs on CNN, Kamau went to Chicago to get beyond the headlines and to ask community members and gang members to tell their own stories. These are people that we rarely see on the cable shows, and it was riveting television. Kamau is also host of three podcasts, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, Politically Reactive, and Kamau Right Now, which airs live here on KALW. And Kamau Bell joins me in studio. Hi, Kamau. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks. My bio's so long, we don't have time to talk.
I know. We don't have time to talk. Well, it's so funny because we air your show, and that's kind of what I knew about you. And now I feel like I just know you so well after reading this book.
Yeah.
And I got to say, huge respect for the work that you're doing on CNN. Because last night's show was just riveting television.
Yeah, I mean, I was really, this season, you know, we did the first season of United Shades of America, and I was happy to be nominated for an Emmy because nobody can accuse me of not being in show business now, which many people did for years, including my dad. But the second season, we really, like, I felt like the first season was like our mixtape, and this is like the album. Like, everything I learned from the first season I've applied and improved on the second season. So an episode like Chicago, I would have done very differently in the first season, but, you know, Chicago's very personal to me. I graduated from high school there. I started stand-up comedy there. So it's really I know some of those issues, but I didn't know them in that way because those neighborhoods were around my neighborhood. I lived in Hyde Park, a very protected bubble. I never went into those neighborhoods or didn't really hang out in those neighborhoods especially. So I knew that it was important that I do it, but I also knew that I needed to try to get it right.
Tell us a little bit about the show United Shades of America.
You know, if the elevator pitch, it's a black guy goes to places you don't expect him to go or you think he absolutely shouldn't go and has conversations with people you either wouldn't expect him to or people you don't think he should talk to at all, which is what I'm learning from this season when I hear back from people. Why did you talk to that person? And the idea is that for me, it's getting outside my comfort zone. Like, you know, there's this idea of this thing called America. And while we are intellectually, many of us realize there's 50 states and we think there's different people out there than us, on some level, most of us think that where we live is the most America. Like, even if whether you live in Berkeley or whether you live in Huntsville, Alabama, you think, well, no, where I live is really the real America. And so the idea for me is to show everybody thinks that wherever they live. But that doesn't mean that you're wrong and they're wrong. It just means that this America is way more complicated than we give it credit for.
And you have a lot of independence, clearly, because you interviewed people that we rarely see on the cable shows, and they were dropping truth bombs.
Yeah, I know people talked about how raw the language was last night.
Yeah,
so for me, the thing with CNN, it's so great. I mean, I know I certainly hear the criticism, and I've been a part of that criticism at times, and I've been on the network criticizing the network as far. There's things to be critical of. They actually like it when people are on the network sparring, clearly. Mm. But for me, all respect due to Lisa Ling and Anthony Bourdain, who went there before me, who sort of established this style of show, and CNN picked it up. And so we know we want another one of those shows, but they want it to be different than Lisa Ling's show. They don't have many shows. They want it to be different than Bourdain's show. I'm not allowed to eat good food on my show. So it's like they just want it to be smart. They want to be funny because I'm a comedian, and they want to not get sued. Like, so if you can sort of get in that area, and I do think it's doing more than it's probably more aggressive, not aggressive, but it's more thoughtful than they were expecting. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like, this is what makes it fun for me, is that I don't have to feel like I have to be just a funny comedian. I can be a person who is a comedian.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about how you got to this place, because it's not like you had friends in high places who no. got you jobs no. doing stand-up or in yeah. comedy or on CNN.
Yeah.
I mean,
no.
you really...
No, my name's not W. Kamau Bell Jeff Zucker. It's
right.
not like I'm not Jeff Zucker's son. Who I wasn't born into the industry. No. I mean, I just was a kid who wanted to be a comedian. And so I wanted... You know, my mom said I would do anything she wanted me to do if she let me stay up and watch Saturday Night Live. So that's where the core is. I'm still that person. But then behind that, like I grew up mostly with my mom. This is a single parent home. The wallpaper in my house was about the revolution and the movement, and not in any sort of like necessarily militant way, but in like my mom was born in Indiana in 1937. So she black only drinking fountains. Black people can't go here. Sit up there. Sit where you have to sit in the section of the movies. So it's just like. And at a point where the civil rights movement had just sort of like the Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, like it's what every black person talked about. People who weren't in the movement talked about the movement. And so I just heard a lot of conversations and had the mom who was like, we're going to this book signing with Alice Walker again, you know, just sort of like, you know, it was just the wallpaper in my house. And then as I grew up, it sort of was like, it's like the kid taking over the family business, whether they want to or not. This is just the family business.
And on the cover of your book, it says that you're a mama's boy. And we should say that in the early 70s, your mom was in the PhD program at Stanford, and she was there to get her doctorate in African-American literature. But you write that she's not a PhD today because she says that at the time, Stanford would not give her a doctorate in that because it wasn't a valid field of study.
Yeah, in the early 70s. That's the story she's always told. Stanford wants to get at me and change the narrative. Please do. But that they didn't feel like there was enough literature in African-American literature. And I mean, again, this is post, like, a like you know, like Zora Neale Hurston. Just Zora Neale Hurston alone is enough to get a PhD on. So for me, it's like that she could have taken a lesser PhD in her mind. I'll just take an English literature. But she just said no. And so for me, that moment and her sort of how she responded to that is the whole story of my life. Like, this would be the easier choice, or this is the choice that makes more sense, but I'm going to go the way that feels better for me.
And even your name, because when your show started airing on KALW, I thought, Kamau. Where does that come from? Well, I learned about it in your book.
Yeah, no, this is a really like a it's like a 300-page Wikipedia article. It's my parents were in East Palo Alto in the early 70s, and they were like a lot of black people who were in the movement and trying to sort of get ties back to Africa. They called themselves a tribe, and they all changed their names, not legally like some black people did, but amongst each other. And I was the first baby born into this tribe, and neither one of my parents can pinpoint who decided the name Kamau why it was Kamau, but it's a very common Kikuyu name. It comes from Kenya, and Kamau, the Mau Maus, which is the warrior class of Kenya, that it's Kamau, quiet warrior. And in Kenya, naming a kid Kamau is like naming a kid Michael here. It's a very common name. So Kenyans are always like, what's going on, sir? Like, they're sort of clear I'm not Kenyan because I don't look like a Kenyan, but they're like, where did this come from? And I'm very happy to say I've been made an honorary Kenyan several times, and I've been ordered to come to Kenya. So, like, not just like invited, like you are coming here someday.
You write that as an American black person, you have no real identity of where your quote African parts come from.
Yeah, I mean, this is short of like the Henry Louis Gates deep dive on your DNA, but I mean, just like even that, you don't really have. Like we were so mixed up in this country through the history of enslaving us that there's not even a strong oral tradition of where we all came from anymore because we were so mixed up and broken up into separate it's hard to even talk about. But so, you know, I can go even get the Henry Louis Gates test, which I may do someday, and find out what the parts are. But it's not the same thing as people who are like, my family comes from Russia these many generations back and came over on this ship at this time. It's not the same thing.
Have you been to the new African Museum in D.C. yet?
I have been. It's the mothership.
It's pretty incredible,
right? It really, like, there's no way to describe it unless you go there. It's not, putting the word museum on it really does it a disservice because it is a 21st century monument to a people. And it really does feel like it might blast off from the earth at some point.
Right. And it's amazing because it's 6 floors, 3 are underground.
Yes.
So you really feel it.
Yeah. And I was in D.C. at one point, like, right after it opened, like, oh, I'd like to go. And then found that you can't just show up. It's not, it's booked for months. But Dave Zirin, political sports reporter, lives in D.C. I was talking to him. He's like, I know a guy. And so I got snuck in through a back door, basically, and only had like an hour or so to be there and just ran around. Really spent a lot of time on the media floor. because all the other floors were booked up, but it was really, that's my floor, really. Mm. And it's just amazing to show. A lot of times museums sort of are talking about things that are long past or feel long past based on how they're framed. But because there's a lot of multimedia in there, I'm like looking like, is that LeBron James from the playoffs over there? Like, you know? And then also, we like to separate things into what's important and what's not important, whereas this is really trying to tell a comprehensive story about, like, LeBron James dunking in the playoffs is connected to those slave ships in the basement.
Yeah. Really incredible. If you want to go, you got to get tickets now because I think you can't get in until something like August.
No, it's
incredible.
I mean, I'm really excited to take my daughters back. Mm. I mean, my wife and my daughters, but especially my daughters, because it's a museum that will engage them. And also, you, as a kid, I was taken to a lot of museums. And at the time, I was like, why are we doing this? And now I'm like, oh, I get it now, Ma. Thanks.
Today, I'm speaking with W. Kamau Bell. He's out with a new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. And I hope you've seen his new show. Actually, it's a year old now, United States of America.
On
CNN. Especially last night's episode about going beyond the headlines in Chicago and asking people to tell their own stories about gun violence and gang violence. Very riveting television. And if you have any questions for W. Kamau Bell, we'd love to hear from you. Any questions about comedy, what it's like to be a comedian in these times? And then also, it's incredible, just watching the show on the cable shows last night, a lot of people were tweeting, I never watch cable, but if I saw this on a regular basis, I would turn it on.
I think as much as we want to demonize these media sources, which I understand because many of them have, there's a lot of work. Like I don't co-sign Jeffrey Lord at CNN. so I want to be clear about that. if they hand the network over to me, he's going to be looking for a job. But the idea that, like, there is, you can get in these spaces, and if you can claim your space and create good work, there's good work to be had there. And I think that for me, like, I only hope that I open the door for the people behind me who can take what I'm doing another step, because this is not the only way it can be done. There are other people and other voices that need to be heard.
Well, and again, that's what I love about your story, because it's not like your dad got you all these jobs.
No.
When you
he wanted to get me a job in insurance. That's the job. You'd be interviewing me about insurance right now. I'd be calling in from Mobile, Alabama. That's the job my dad wanted me to have.
When you were at the University of Pennsylvania, you just weren't really into college.
No, I wasn't into that. I think if I'd gone to one of those colleges where they grade you on your feelings, like what a Reed in Oregon or something, like, I would have been able to create my own major. But Penn is a very pre-professional school. It's like doctors and lawyers and business people and nurses, and really not like there wasn't. I sort of looked at the school like, is there something creative here? And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I always knew I wanted to be a comedian, but I certainly wasn't trying to look for a major in stand-up comedy. But is there something here I can do to justify all the money that I'm spending here, or my parents are spending here? And there wasn't. So I was like, again, it's like my mom dropping out of Stanford. I was like, you're not going to give me the degree that I want, so I got to get out of here. But for me, it was really a financial decision, because I don't want to owe all this money and not have a degree that I want. You know, so
a couple weeks before graduating, you had some time to kill, so you just started cracking jokes.
Yeah, it was before I dropped out, actually. A couple weeks before, because I didn't graduate from Penn. So it was a couple weeks before I dropped out. I was there for about a year and a half. And I just was like, really, because I knew I was dropping out, and there was like, I had to wait a certain period of time. I don't remember what it was, but there was time I had on campus when I didn't have to go to class. I knew I was dropping out. And so I just got to sort of be free to be myself and wake up whenever I wanted to and hang out in my friend Francis's room. I think he lives in Sunnyvale now. We're hanging out in Francis's room, and his room was like the hub of the hall. And so people would just come through. And that was when I found out I could be funny on demand and make lots of different people laugh. And when I became known for being funny to people, which in my life, I was never publicly known as being the funny guy. My best friends knew that, but not everybody. And it would be, I would hear people introduce me, this is Kamau, he's hilarious. I'm like, I am? And then a guy that I knew, his name's Seth, was like, you should be a stand-up comedian. And I sort of played it off like, oh, I don't know if I could do that. And I was like, yes! And it was like, sort of, I always remember that as like hearing it reflected back at me was one of those things that helped me start to do it for the first time.
You write that more and more through your time in comedy, and you did a lot of open mics and then stand-up comedy, you were realizing the difference between black and white comedy circles, and that you didn't really fit into either one.
Yeah, I think there was a point with the book where we were working on the press release, and they were saying, talking about how he writes how he didn't feel in the, I didn't, he thought, Kamau writes about how he didn't fit into black comedy circles. I was like, I also didn't fit into white comedy circles, so it's not that black guy. Don't make the narrative that clean. And, you know, at the time that I started doing stand-up comedy, Def Comedy Jam was big on HBO, and black comedy became a mainstream thing and a thing that people talked about. Like, and there was a sense that almost, as it always happens when something becomes mainstream, that becomes the only thing that people talk about. So the idea of the big broad, brash, profane, deaf comedy jam style, which is hilarious, was kind of what every black comedian felt like they needed to do. And many of us fall into that, but I didn't, and many others don't. But some people try to fake it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't do that. That's not my style. I don't do that. I don't live that way. And then in white comedy clubs, I would sometimes be too black or not the kind of black they wanted, because they kind of wanted a Def Jam guy too sometimes. Or they wanted the guy who was like one of the good ones, who's, I'm not like those other black people. And I felt like I'm neither one of those things. And so I had to go outside of those circles. I had to go outside of those linear circles to find my space.
You also say that you started to stop. You stopped talking about racism because you just weren't connecting with the way a lot of other black comics were successfully doing jokes about racism, but then you were telling jokes that you didn't care about.
Yes. Yeah, no, that was a fallow period for me. I have friends who remember me from that time. Like, I would tell a joke that was kind of about racism, but not that really on point, because I was trying to sort of give it to the audience the way I thought they wanted, which, if you're writing for the audience instead of writing for yourself, it's never going to be that good, I don't think, at least for me. And then I would do jokes that were just about, like, man, do you ever notice that men and women's magazines have different covers? You know, just things that were like, who cares? Like, there's probably a good joke in there somewhere, but not for me. And so, like, it was just this thing where it was like, it was a pretty scattershot approach that ultimately the audience isn't getting to know who I am. And if you're going to sort of make it in comedy, mm-hmm. you have to have a strong point of view. People have to, even if they don't like the joke, they sort of appreciate the perspective or know what the perspective is.
You always wonder when you see comedy, what goes on behind the scenes? How does this person prepare? Is a lot of it scripted? How much of it is improv?
Yeah.
I also liked reading about the part when you got booed.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that story.
I mean, first of all, it wasn't the only time, but it was a big time. It was early on. I was into comedy like less than 3 years, like at a point where I was sort of, a lot of comics who are in 3 years, you can be get pretty good if you're working the right rooms and doing the right stuff. But I was not doing that. And it was also during the downtime of stand-up comedy's boom bust period. It was during the bust. And I had a big guest spot at a big club in Chicago, 300 people in a packed room, excited for this new club to open. And I was doing a guest spot, which is the spot where you go up, you're not booked to be on the show, you're not paid. But if that spot goes well, they might pay you to perform. And so it was a big opportunity for me, especially as a young comedian who wasn't working at all, had not been paid anywhere to do comedy. Mm. And I went on stage and I thought I was going to be funny and improv-y, and I basically insulted a woman in the club. And they chose her over me, rightfully so. And within about 3 seconds, the audience started to, like, boo me. And the thing is, now if I get booed, I'd really like, oh, is that what we're doing? Like, I would lean into it and sort of make that into the thing. But at the time, I just folded like a house of cards. Like, I just got blown over and I walked up. The worst thing you can do in a comedy club is get off stage before your time is up.
Wow.
The club would rather you bomb for your entire time than get off stage early, because that throws the whole show off.
You would just have to keep talking and try to get the crowd back.
You have to just get, it's like when you go to work and if you get to work and at 9:30 in the morning, you're like, this day is a bad day. You can't leave. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to suffer through the day. you can't just, if you decide you're not enjoying this interview with me, you can't just go.
Right.
Like, that's the least you have to do is fill the time.
Dead air. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like in the same thing in comedy club. But it's even sadder. It's like, if you get off stage, you're saying, I couldn't handle 7 minutes more. Like, which is just like, how weak are you? So it makes you look really bad. And there was lots of other comics there who were like, as the comic said to me that night, sometimes you eat the bear, sometimes the bear eats you.
A lot of the other comics avoided you. You were kind of just there standing around.
I was radioactive, and I wasn't enough on the scene that anybody felt like. I mean, my friend Dwayne was there, but he was talking to other people, and I became radioactive at that point.
And when I read this, I wondered, now that Kamau has all these podcasts and the show on CNN, have you heard from some of these comics?
No,
that
I mean,
you worked with at that time?
I mean, I hear from people all the time who remember me from back in the day. Mm. And there's sort of, I mean, really, there's a bunch of people who think comedy is cutthroat and competitive. There really is a sense of, like, good for you for succeeding, because I know how hard this industry is. The haters don't generally reach out, you know, like, but they're just sort of suffering in silence at your success. But although sometimes on Twitter they do behind egg avatars. But yeah, like, the comics who I've heard from back in the day are just like, they know how long it's been since I first started doing comedy, and they know how hard it is to get paid once, let alone over and over again, and to also get a show on TV. In some sense, it gives people hope for, like, okay, what can I learn from Kamau, which is what I hope people do.
You write about white comics and black comics. You don't write as much about male comics and female comics. And I wonder, mm-hmm. what experiences have you had with female comics, and what are the main differences you see?
It's funny. There's a section of the book that I actually think about a lot, which is a section where I talk about women aren't funny.
Mm.
And so that's my, I think that was probably my pouring all my thoughts into that one section. But, like, you know, I think there's an idea that because the male gaze and the white gaze are considered to be the normal gaze, that you hear a lot of times male comedians of all races say that women aren't funny, when what they're really saying is women aren't funny to me, which is fine if not pigheaded. It's that comedy is very subjective. But and they're forgetting to put the "to me" part, because the male gaze and the white gaze are the gaze of the country. And so, I mean, G-A-Z-E. Let me be clear about that. Like, I realize I'm on the radio, you might not know. But yeah, that's the lens the country is looking through. And for me, you know, the thing about stand-up comedy that I've learned is that the funniest women don't often go into stand-up comedy, because a lot of stand-up comedy is things they tell single women not to do by themselves. You're going to drive to a small town by yourself and stay in a Motel 6 with a broken lock on the door, and you're going to go on stage in a bar with drunks who are going to not want to hear a woman's opinions about anything. And it's going to pay you $15 after you pay for your gas and everything else.
Because you've done
that. Yeah, I've done that. I don't want to do it as a 6'4", 250-pound black dude who is not necessarily in the same level of vulnerability. So for me, it's like, maybe there's not the same number of women stand-up comedians as there are men stand-up comedians, because I think stand-up comedy specifically is a very weird, specific thing to do, that if you're Tina Fey, you're like, I'm just going to go to Second City. Or if you're Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I'm just going to get on Saturday Night Live and work my craft, and then who's funnier than her? So for me, there's a sort of idea that stand-up comedy is the real funny.
Or if you're Samantha Bee, you're going to say, I'm going to get my own show.
Yeah.
One of the only women who's doing late-night comedy.
And I'm going to get my own show as some sort of like weird back-end deal because Jon Stewart leaves The Daily Show, and I realize I'm not being appreciated around here.
Right.
And my husband has a deal. Me and my husband have a deal at another network, and they're like, would you like a show too, Samantha? Sure. Like, it was like not the plan. But you have to, when you're not the dominant culture, you have to look for opportunities where opportunities aren't even there sometimes.
And here he is, Kamau Bell, author of the new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. And he's also host of United Shades of America on CNN. His show, Live with Kamau Bell, airs here on KALW. And if you have any questions or comments for Kamau, actually it's Kamau right now, excuse me, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Donna in Richmond. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the show. All right, you can take another bite of your bagel.
Oh, we're
trying to get Donna. Do we have Donna?
Yes.
Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Kamau.
Hi.
You know, I wanted to thank you very much for your recent article in the New York Times summoning people from Berkeley to go to the beaches in Alabama.
Thank you very much.
I really, really love that article. I thought it was excellent. And in fact, because I came from California from the East Coast 25 years ago, and I've never really felt that at home here, and I just love the way that you kind of called out the Berkeleyans to have like a broader perspective of the world and the beaches and going somewhere that's really fun and awesome, and it really spoke to me because I just come back from a awesome vacation in Florida.
There you go.
I was on the Gulf Coast at Siesta Key, which, by the way, is the number one rated beach in the whole United States.
And
I had an awesome time. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. The people are so friendly. I mean, I just feel very drawn to the East Coast, but I hadn't been to Florida in like 25 years. And I have to say, you know, I want to go to your beach in Alabama. It's awesome. And I really thank you for, you know, offering up a different perspective to Berkeleyans, and I hope they take you up on it, because I was actually insulted at the Berkeley Y by somebody who, like, noticed my tan and asked me where I came from. And I said, well, I just had a big, wonderful vacation in Florida. Like, oh, not Hawaii?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I was really happy to write that piece. The New York Times sort of wanted me to figure out something from the book I could adapt, and they said something about the South and how we need to. I was like, got it. Don't worry. Stop talking. And yeah, so I was able to write that piece. And I was really happy about writing that piece because it was like, you know, in this current media era where the New York Times is lefty, sort of identified as the most lefty, left-leaning, blah, blah, blah. And also I'm identified as being from Berkeley and with the United States where you're some sort of lefty, blah, 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 to be like, come to Alabama. Like, I was like, nobody's expecting this. And I also knew that it would make my dad very proud, and it did. Like, it was like to be able to be published in the New York Times and to make my dad, who lives in Alabama, more proud about where he has chosen to live, even though he could live anywhere and has lived in New York, I felt really good about that.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Donna. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with W. Kamau Bell about his new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Tales of a 6'4 African-American, Heterosexual, Cisgender, Left-Leaning, Asthmatic, Black and Proud, Blurred, Black Nerd, Mama's Boy, Dad, and Stand-Up Comedian. And Kamau is also host of Kamau Right Now. It's the live show that airs here on KALW. He's also host of United Shades of America on CNN. I hope you can see last night's show. It's really incredible. Kamau and his team went to Chicago to get beyond the headlines and ask community members and gang members to tell their own stories. And these are people we rarely see on the cable shows. It really was riveting television. And after the break, we'll play a couple of quotes from gang members, really stating the obvious. We want jobs. We want our schools funded. And next week, Kamau is going to Indian country, and I'm really excited to see that. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by W. Kamau Bell. He's out with a new book called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. You know Kamau Bell because he hosts Kamau Right Now, which airs live here on KALW. He's also the host of three podcasts, and he's the host of United Shades of America on CNN. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Before we get back to calls, I want to ask you, you have a massive platform now. You've been on Fresh Air a bunch of times, mm-hmm. The Daily Show. You're doing three podcasts, live shows, mm-hmm. United Shades of America. You're married. You have two kids.
Also part of the platform, yes.
Yeah. And during this time that we're living in, when you sit down in your alone time and you think about what you want to accomplish and what you want to focus on, what goes through your mind? How do you decide?
Am I doing this right? That's really that at the core. It's like, am I fooling myself? Do I think I'm doing something? Am I actually being inclusive, or do I think I'm being inclusive? Am I just nodding toward it? Mm-hmm. Am I actually really doing the thing? And I know inclusion is a word that has probably been so said now it's gotten on a bad name. But am I actually? Because, you know, I get pushback a lot. Every time I open Twitter, I'm getting pushback. So like with the Richard Spencer interview I did in the first episode, I got a lot of pushback about that. And so I had to ask myself, are these people right? Could be that they're right. Could be that I did do the wrong thing. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've had to intellectualize it and say it out loud, the more I'm like, no, I did the thing I should have done. Now, does that mean I would, am I taking that feedback into the next time I do it? Is it going to affect how I do things differently? Yeah, because you go, all right, well, how can I do this to make it clearer about why I'm doing this? But not necessarily that I'm constantly, I'm my worst critic. Despite what you think on people on Twitter, I'm a way harder on myself than you are on me.
I also appreciated that you pulled back the layers on yourself in some ways, because you can come across as this funny guy who's very tall and confident. And when I heard about you interviewing Richard Spencer, going to that alt-right meeting and then interviewing members of the Klan, mm-hmm. I thought, how in the hell did he do this? Mm-hmm. Yes, he's funny, but something must have happened behind mm-hmm. the scenes. And sure enough, mm-hmm. you write about that in your book, that it really affected you personally.
Yeah, I mean, there was there's the side of this that's like when I'm interviewing, especially the Klan, that like, because Richard Spencer is just a guy. He's connected to some horrible ideas, and those ideas are in the White House, which is why I felt like I needed to talk to, or was happy to put him, not happy, but it felt like it was important to put him on the show. But the Klan, that's America's homegrown terrorist group that was basically formed as a way to go, well, slavery's not legal anymore, but how do we still oppress these people? And they were supported by governments and politicians and business leaders. And for me, so talking to them, I'm sort of stepping in history. And I couldn't help but realize that, like, maybe these guys haven't done anything. Maybe to them it's just a costume. I don't know enough to know. But that this has terrorized my people in this country, and, you know, also Jewish people and even Catholic people at a certain point, that this is a terrorist group. And I have to sort of, like, the thing I can do is not be cowed by them in this moment, just to not back down to them. So when they try to irritate me or agitate me, or even Richard Spencer, you're going to, like he said at one point, I'm going to say something you may find politically incorrect. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, shut up, dude. Like, what are you, like, I'm not going to be, you know. And so when people see me laughing, they think somehow, some people think that's weakness. That's strength, because mm-hmm. I'm laughing off this nonsense.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm taking it seriously enough because I know it's in the White House. But you're not going to make me blink on this show.
Let's play a clip from that scene where you were in D.C. when that, quote, alt-right meeting was taking place, mm-hmm. when they Some of the people in the crowd did the Hitler sign, and it did get videotaped. It's out there for everybody to see. And you're going to hear someone from the National Review speaking, and Kamau will mention his name. And this is a clip from United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell.
It's not as fun as I thought it was going to be. When Obama won, it was like a party. I thought I'd be like nervous or afraid, but I feel like they might start selling timeshares.
Trump and Steve Bannon are not all right people. They're certainly not white nationalists. Trump in particular is endlessly going on about how much he loves minorities and tacos and so on and so forth. White nationalists tend not to do that.
That taco hater right there is Peter Bremola, a writer and former editor at Forbes magazine and the National Review. He's kind of the Cub Scout leader of the alt-right.
Some of you may have seen the news now. It's Vice President Pence. He was booed repeatedly by the audience. If anybody had done anything like this to Barack Obama, the media would have lynched them. We can use that word lynch now because we don't have to worry about physical correctness. There is no quote-unquote diverse America. There's only white America. The people who voted for Trump, they are America. Everyone else is just along for the ride.
Whew, this American ride is making me nauseous. Maybe I'm not tall enough to ride. Time to talk to the people here. And out of about 200 people in the room...
And that is a clip from United Shades of America on CNN. When he said it's okay to use the word lynched again, You just turn around and look at the camera.
The audio doesn't do justice to the fact that silence in there was me turning, looking at the camera like, did you hear that? You know, that it's like sometimes you don't have to say anything. It's just the idea that you can look at the camera. I mean, I probably stole that from the British version of The Office, Tim's look to cameras. But, you know, to me, it's just like, it's a way to take like a yellow highlighter out and go, highlight this right here. Did you hear that? And for me, this is in D.C., in like the Ronald Reagan room of some building. Like, and that guy used to write for the Forbes and National Review. These are accredited publications. Like, people go, why would you put that on TV? To show people how pervasive this is. And I think some people who watch that go, I know that. You're not everybody. Everybody's not as hashtag woke as you. And I think people right now on the left, because there's so much hecticness around the current administration that it's making our critique even hectic. Like, I'm trying to bring more people into the movement. I'm not trying to say that we're all equally woke. We all know what we need to know.
This is such an important point because so many people said, why would you give a platform to these guys? And you said, you need to fully understand what's happening in this country in the year 2017.
Yeah. I think the idea of this platform normalization thing that I keep hearing about is like, it's very clear on the show whose side I'm on. The show's mostly about immigrants and refugees and their story, their beautiful and harrowing stories of how they came to this country and what they're either providing for this country and giving to this country and innovating in this country or what they hope to do so. And it's really sort of trying to rescue that narrative. But if you tell that story without telling the story of the fact that there are groups in this country who are fighting against that, and specifically, Richard Spencer's not nobody. His ideas are in the White House. Her in the White House. We couldn't get an interview with Steve Bannon. You know what I'm saying? He won't even talk to himself. But we got a guy who is credited as inventing the term that Steve Bannon had, the Breitbart. So for me, it's like, it just becomes so intellectually lazy. Mm-hmm. And also it says you're afraid of those ideas if you don't want more people to hear those ideas. Because, again, I'm on CNN. I said this before, and this is not meant to diss. I'm not on Democracy Now!'s YouTube channel. Like, I'm literally not preaching to the converted by being on CNN. That is not, it's not even MSNBC from a year ago when it was all lean forward or lean in. Whatever. This is CNN. Jeffrey Lord is coming on right after me. Yeah. I'm there to sort of wake the people up who think, I think I agree with Donald Trump. Wait, what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the show is called United Shades of America on CNN. W. Kamau Bell is out with a new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, and you hear him on KALW with his live show, Kamau Right Now. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I just want to really thank you, Kama, for, you know, helping to bring more political and intelligent comedy to the mainstream, and for also supporting women of color comics, especially black lesbians like Karina Dobbins and Nisha Mosley and other really excellent comics. And, you know, I'm just wondering, I grew up in New York, and my family was friends with, like, Jonathan Winters and Johnny Carson, and it just seemed so unhealthy, and they were always feeling pressured to be funny and it was very sexist. So, A, I appreciate you pulling comics out of that. But I'm just wondering, do you feel the pressure, you talked a little bit about how to be a comic, but the pressure to be funny all the time? That seemed really pathological among those two.
I mean, I think on some level, luckily I've curated an audience that sort of the people who like me want me to be me all the time. So I think that's a good thing. But there, you do feel the pressure, especially when you're in the middle of like all this promotion stuff, that you have to be on 100% of the time and you have to sort of have your talking points ready to go. That is pressure. The hard part about comedy, and Johnny Carson and Jonathan Winters both have sort of enacted this in different ways in their lives or were affected by this, is that you put a lot of pressure on that time to be funny, like on camera, on the radio or whatever, and especially on a show. You do like a show for an hour and you're funny, you get the everybody's cheering, and you get off stage and you have all this energy that you're holding because people just cheered and clapped and thought you said you were the best, and you get off stage and you kind of have to be a person again. And it's really hard to figure out what to do with that energy, especially when you're on the road in some place where you don't know anybody or you're by yourself. I think that's why a lot of comics drink. I think that's why a lot of comics do drugs. I think it's an easy path to mental illness if you don't know how to get out of those thoughts, if you don't know how to sort of get yourself out of there. I feel like, to me, people don't talk enough about all that stored up energy you have after you come out of the spotlight, and you still feel like, what do I do now? Nobody's telling me I'm the best. And it is certainly, I talk about in the book how the pressure of United States, of Totally Biased, just led me to bad places with my marriage. And, you know, and that we had to like, I had to really like, my wife really was like, you gotta really get right with yourself here, sir. And, you know, I chose my family over that show on some level.
You write that the pressure and the hours during that show were terrible. You weren't healthy. At some point, your eyes turned red, and you almost filed for divorce. And it was a really difficult time.
Yeah, I want to be very specific about this. It was the idea was suddenly like, is this what's going to happen? Mm. Is this that showbiz story where the guy is with the woman for over his whole, like from the very beginning, and then he gets successful and then he leaves her? Like, you know, like it's sort of like that. We've heard that story before, and you'll hear it again. And so for me, it was just like, and also my daughter's like two. Am I going to be seeing her on monitored times? Like every, like, and also I'm working a lot, so I'm not. Like, and the whole idea is, as much as it was like hard, and at some level, it's weird to say that sometimes, because in my life, my parents weren't married to each other. They both been married twice separately from the relationship together. And like, so I come from that. I come from people who are like, that's enough of this nonsense, I'm leaving. And so for me, it's like, it's sort of a choice that's in my head, that was in my head, that was sort of bred into me. It's like my parents weren't married. So, and then it was just like, the as hard as it was, and as much as it seemed like kind of a, and this is a bad thing to say, an easy thing to leave your wife and your kid because you don't have to deal with like the problems, it made me nauseous. And even right now talking about it, it makes me nauseous to think about like not being a part of my family and not seeing my family at the end of every day, and also like seeing my kid raised through, you know, the best thing to stop you from getting a divorce if you have kids is to imagine your kid calling some other kid dad. Like, I think for me, I was like, no, we're not doing that.
As also the child of divorce, huge respect to you for not putting your kids through that, because it's very hard.
Yeah.
Today we're joined by W. Kamau Bell. He's out with a new book about his life, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. He's the host of Kamau Right Now. It's a live show that airs here on KALW and United Shades of America, which airs on CNN. Let's talk about last night's show more in depth. You spent your childhood in Chicago. Last year, there were 216 murders, and so many, as you pointed out on the show, so many in the media paint the city with one big black brush.
Yeah, I think it was 700 some murders.
By what was it?
Yeah, I think.
Did somebody, I type some, that wrong? 716.
716.
Oh, geez,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I just want to be. 216 is plenty, and that's horrible, but I just want to be, make sure we're accurate.
Thank you.
You know, it was just important to me to go back to Chicago and feel it, because I hear people talk about the city as being Chicago is like, you know, President Trump, for example, talks about it, carnage of Chicago. And it makes it sound like every street corner is Mad Max beyond the, you know, Thunderdome. And it's just like, and it's just not that way. And first of all, the north side of Chicago and downtown Chicago is it could be any city at any time, just people living their lives. It's the south and west side specifically. And even those neighborhoods are not in carnage. Like, there was just shootings last night after my show aired. CNN had breaking news about people being murdered in gang violence in Chicago, whatever gang violence is. But, you know, so for me, it's like, first of all, trying to say Chicago's not a monolith. It's not one thing. And also, we need to talk to the people who live in those neighborhoods about, well, what is Chicago? And one of the things I asked, is it better or worse than the media thinks it is? And these guys were like, it's worse.
Mm. That really struck me.
Yeah.
You went to one of the hottest pockets of violence in Chicago, one of the most infamous projects. And let's play a clip. This is a conversation between W. Kamau Bell with longtime rival gang members. And this episode of United Shades of America aired last night on CNN, and you can watch it online now. Here's a clip from that conversation.
We just talked to about 7 or 8 little youngsters now. And it came across to me as well, to others that was with me, that we're reaching out, but the younger generation is not reaching back out to us. They stuck into what they're doing.
Somewhere we failed them. Yeah. And we failed, and that young motherfucker that I failed, that be the motherfucker that killed me. Because I missed out on it.
And I mean, on some level, weren't you failed by the, you know, it's a cycle, right? You know?
Yeah, it's a cycle. Mm-hmm. It's a cycle.
See, a lot of older cats, they let it slide. So bad slide so long, now it's out of hand.
The people who are watching at home, they know the phrase gang banging and gang banging. What does that actually mean if you're actually on the streets?
It all sourced around protecting your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And people took it, the media took it into text as gang banging.
Yeah.
We're not gang banging. Yeah. Never have been gang banging.
Now, for the younger generations, what does that mean for them?
When we came up, there was no Instagram or Twitter. Mm-hmm. Twitter and Instagram is the new streets.
Yeah.
Y'all got beef. Y'all Facebook laughing each other. Y'all tweeting each other. That's where the clashing is.
This social media and this internet get people killed.
Hell yeah.
These posts are serious threats and known as cyberbanging, which honestly, I would have guessed was something completely different.
When I became a father and had kids, suddenly things started to feel more crucial to me. Mm-hmm. So is that a part of this too?
Of course, you being a dad, you want everything. You want the world for your kids. Exactly. But you try to protect them on what's going on. You try to make them avoid the mistakes that you made, mm-hmm. and try to make their life better.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. within today's society, it's kind of hard.
Yeah, it is.
If you could control all these circumstances, how would you make it better in these neighborhoods?
We need jobs.
Right? Yeah.
Jobs.
Yeah.
Pay rate need to go up, because you can't, everybody happy with money.
Yeah.
You got to give these shorties back some hope, man.
While the meeting is ending on a call for hope, I can't help but think about how it all started with the news of another gun victim. And how when the meeting ended, everyone just did what we all do. Talked about dinner plans and took some selfies. To them, this is normal. This should not be normal.
That's a clip from United Shades of America on CNN. That one aired last night. W. Kamau Bell went to Chicago to get beyond the headlines, and he was meeting with longtime rival gang members in that clip. One of the leaders who was supposed to be at that meeting was shot right before they all met. The gang members actually protected the space, and every young man in that room says that he has had a gun pointed at him. Kamau, the thing that so many things stood out for me, but we need jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other quotes, we're not getting the same resources as other communities, and we don't even have basketball hoops.
Yes. Yeah, the things that we even sort of associate with those neighborhoods, like, they're like, nobody's trying to be in the NBA anymore. You know, these guys, they don't, there's not the same thing. And I've heard this before, like, it used to be that the kid who had a good jump shot, the neighborhood protected, like, don't get him involved in the life, or the kid who was an A student, don't get that kid involved in the life. But things have gotten so crucial and so just out of control in those neighborhoods that's not the case anymore. People are just focused on survival, you know? And I think that, you know, when you talk about a city like Chicago, and I know the Illinois budget apparently hasn't passed in the last couple of years, some sort of crazy, but it's not a poor city. Like, I mean, there's resources in that city. On the north side, there are buildings being put up. There are plenty of jobs. You can see help wanted signs everywhere. On the south side, you're talking about, in the west side, you're talking about miles and miles of undeveloped land. Land has been left fallow. Like, you know, so where it's like, and it's not even a park, because there's like fences around the land. So it's like you're talking about undeveloped land that just left to sit fallow that could be businesses, could be homes, could be community gardens. There are a few, but there's not enough. All these things that are just left sitting fallow, and people are like, you know, you can't walk out your house and go look for a job if you're a teenager in the south and west side of Chicago. You can do that on the north side. You can do that if you live in certain communities in San Francisco. You can just walk down the street and look who's hiring.
Right.
There's no jobs.
And this is obviously not unique to Chicago.
No. And that's the other thing about when the president demonizes Chicago, he's actually doing a really bad job of it. He's actually also ignoring other communities that have it worse than Chicago. Communities that actually are in poverty, like where there actually is no money to bring in new jobs. You know, people in Appalachia are like, hey, man, like, that's why they're so focused on coal. That's all they know they have there. But like those people are Chicago, the city will always be sort of the like. The rich people in Chicago will always be okay because Chicago will always attract that kind of money. But in places like Appalachia, even the rich people are like, hey, man, we could, you know, so it's like, I think that's the other thing is when you demonize one town, what you're doing is actually you're ignoring lots of other places.
And how do you process the information that you get from these communities? And again, these people we hardly ever see on the cable shows. When they're stating the obvious, they know what solutions they need. They need healthy food, music, a basketball court would be nice, and jobs. How do you process all that this time especially?
I mean, a lot of times it makes me feel like, okay, what can I do specifically? Forget the show, but like, what can I do here to help these people out? Like, I was just at the Boys and Girls Club in Chicago where we screened this episode of the show to like teenage kids who like are in the life and also were watching the show. And I was like, do they even, you know, it's not really made for them, but they watched it and they, at the end, and Van Jones was there and Malik Youssef, who was in the episode, and a lot of the men from that summit were there. They came to the screening. And so I got to see them see it, which was really a privilege. And it makes me go like, okay, what can I do for this Boys and Girls Club? You know, I feel like we have to crowdfund democracy on some level. Like, you know, we can't expect that the government in this town goes, it's good for the Boys and Girls Club to have all the resources they need. We actually have to go, okay, what can I do? you know, like, I mean, there's a Berkeley public school across the street from my house that my kids don't go to. And every now and again, I go on donors choose and go, what do they need? You know, oh, for $57, I can help you get some school supplies. Well, I'm going to do that if I can. You know, like, so for me, it's like, that's what it comes down to is like, is there anything I can do on a super basic level to actually give them some of the resources? Like, Chance the Rapper just gave the Chicago public school system $1 million. The Chicago Bulls matched that and they gave another $1 million. Are we really leaving it to the rappers and the sports teams? Like, is that what it's come to? You got to hope that Chance the Rapper has an extra $1 million to get up off of. And he's not Jay-Z. He's not a dude who's sitting on, you know, unlimited funds. And, you know, on some level, he's sort of betting on himself that he'll be okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's like he gave them $1 million. And I feel like that's what we have to do. But it's like, but the other thing is like right now we're in a march phase of our society, of our civilization, like right here. And I feel like we have to get out in the streets and we have to really make our voices heard because we have to hold these people to a higher account. I think France looked at us and went like, oh, that really doesn't work out. Let's go the other way. Even if the other way isn't as far the other way as we'd like it to be, it's at least we're not going to falsely equivalent these two candidates. You know, so we're going to, you know, I feel like that's the like, you know, we are already an object lesson for the world.
Mm. We don't have much time left, but you're going to Indian country on next week's United Shades.
Yeah. No, I was super honored and privileged to be, you know, we were able to go to Standing Rock while Standing Rock was still like in full bore. And I know a lot of those camps still exist. They've moved from out of that area, but we were there right when it was in the thick of the, as much as it ever got into the news cycle. Yep. And so we, you know, and they didn't invite every media person in there. And certainly CNN is not always like a badge of like, oh yes, of course. So, and we got to sit down and talk to amazing people like Tara Huska and Adam Beach, and also just people at the encampments. And then we also went to Pine Ridge and talked to families in Pine Ridge. And one of the most impactful segments of the show is a family in Pine Ridge whose son had been killed by gang violence 3 days before. And their cousin were like, you should go to their house right now. So within minutes, people who had never heard of us before invited us into their house while they were having a memorial service for their son who had been killed 3 days before. And that's why I read, it's a testament to CNN that they that's not a place a comedian is supposed to go. But they just go, yeah, we'll figure it out. Just do what you do and do a good job.
Yeah, well, that's a testament to you for wanting to tell these stories.
I feel like it's if I have the public microphone right now, like I feel like therefore I have to use it responsibly.
Respect.
Thank you.
W. Kamau Bell is author of The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell and host of the live show Kamau Right Now, host of 3 podcasts. You can find them at yourcallradio.org and United Shades of America on CNN. And I really hope you can watch the Chicago episode, which you can find online right now. W. Kamau Bell, great to meet you in person. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for your work.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here. I'm a fan of your work, and I'm thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Really climbed this ladder on his own. It's a really fun book. 800-525-9917. We also didn't get to talk about race that much and some of your personal experiences, but there are some stories in here about Kamau that will really open your eyes, talking about living in Berkeley.
Yeah. It's just Elmwood Cafe. That's all I'll say.
Yep. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
We are very happy to bring you these conversations, but we really do it in partnership with you. And it's because there's a community here that supports this station that we could bring. When Kamau came to KALW and said, I'm interested in making a public radio show. I want to do something based in the Bay Area that brings forward voices that I think are not being heard, that really should be paid more attention to. Your support made it possible for us to say, yeah, we can take that opportunity. Show your support now. You can be part of Kamau Right Now, which is the show that we produce in partnership with Kamau. May 19th, that's a Thursday evening at the Bayview Opera House in San Francisco, 2 front of the house seats for a $150 contribution to KALW. Make the call now at 800-525-9917, especially as we have a challenge, and that is to get 20 people to support your call in this hour, which is to say in the next 7 minutes or so, because we count till 5 after the hour. If we do that, Linda Eby in Oakland and Gary Sullivan and Timothy Lynn in San Francisco will kick in an additional $500 for local public radio.
And when is that performance?
That is on Thursday, May 19th.
May 19th. 800-525-9917. For $150, we will send you a pair of tickets.
Hold on.
Oh, we're almost out?
No, I think it's Thursday, May 18th. I have an ongoing battle with days and dates, as people may know.
May 18th.
To work with me.
May 18th.
May 18th. 800-525-9917. And Kamau loves KALW so much, he got up at 5:30 to come and sit with Matt. By this time, I'm almost falling asleep. So thanks for coming in, Kamau. 800-525-9917. Also, for $120, we will send you W. Kamau Bell's new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org.
Thanks to Rich Wilson in San Francisco, Dorothy Kidd, also here in the city, and Kenneth Young, all of whom went to KALW.org or called 800-525-9917 in this hour. This is how we do it, one person at a time. But the clock is ticking, and we're asking you during this challenge to give your support. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. Support local independent radio, a station that airs Kamau Right Now live here on KALW. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
And just to be clear, this is Kamau talking. This is bigger than me. I'm just the hot dogs at Costco to sell you the giant TV. There's major work happening at KALW that's not just the people talking into the microphones. Yep. It's the people behind the scenes who make the work happen and actually physically keep the voices on the radio. So you have to really support those people. It's always fun to support the people on the front, but it's really the back end where the narratives get changed and where the show happens. Yep. That's why you're supporting.
800-525-9917. Thanks to Adi Horn in San Francisco, and thank you, Kamau. Adi actually had a nice comment. She says, I'm a San Francisco public school teacher, and I use clips from Kamau's broadcast to talk about racism, sexism, and equity. So, oh, and he says he's funny and wise.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, what can you say?
You're going to be in the gratitude circle at dinner tonight.
Thank you so much, Adi. Be the next person to join Adi. Join the other folks who are on the line right now at 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917.
KALW.org, 800-525-9917. For $150, we'll send you a pair of tickets to Kamau Right Now on Thursday, May 18th. You can also get the book, $120, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. And your contribution goes to independent local radio, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
800-525-9917. Just a few minutes left in this challenge. Just 30 seconds before we go to the BBC News headlines and then into On Point. Your support makes it all happen. 800-525-9917.
That's right. And if you see me in the streets with one of those books and you say KALW, I will sign it for you because I always keep a Sharpie on me. Support KALW at 800-525-9917, KALW.org.
Thank you, Kamau. And thank you so much.